I want to pick up where we left off last week, which was, I believe we left him at Rachza. So that's on page 318. I don't think we're going to get through the whole thing tonight. So if we don't get through the whole Seder, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't do the whole Seder. But we'll see where we get to. Okay. So page 318. So we have Orchatz at the beginning of the Seder. And we discussed last week that that's for watching for the vegetable, which some say it's just meant to stir the curiosity of the kids. And others say that really that's a din, that's a halacha that applies year-round, that we're supposed to wash our hands before we have any sort of fruit or vegetable that is that's moist. So comes the Gemara in Psachim on Daf Kuftet Vav Amud Beis and asks the question, why do I have to wash my hands twice? Because we already did it with Orchatz. And so the Gemara answers that because we said Haggadah, we said part of Hallel in between Karpas and when we have Matzah. So Dilma Suche Asre L'dayte V'nagal. So maybe I wasn't paying attention and my hands might have touched an area that's impure. So I think the general guideline is that any part of the body that is sort of like, you know, internal. So if I put my hand in my mouth, my ears, even, you know, the hair was considered to be relatively not clean if you go to the bathroom. So all those would be reasons to wash your hands again. So that's the reason why the Gemara says we wash our hands a second time. So Shmuel Alekhet says that in theory, if I have in mind, or if it is very clear to me that I did not touch anything, by the way, Kisvei Kodesh, right? So let's say, I don't know, for some reason, if you have a Miguel's Esther lying around and you were to touch it. So that also renders the hands impure. That was for a particular reason that we won't get into right now. But Shibuli Lekit says that if I know I didn't touch anything that would render my hands impure, so then I really shouldn't have to wash my hands again. That would seem to be the logical conclusion. But Beis Yosef argues on that in source 37. It says, "V'nirali de'ein lechavim b'chach shelo levatal takanas lechavim shetikno lito pamayim b'leil Pesach." So, as we know, that the Seder night is orchestrated in a particular way, and not that there isn't any sort of flexibility, but the basic structure of how we do things is from Chazal, and that's what they instituted. So, even though there might be technical reasons why we do certain things, once it's part of the Seder, we try to preserve the minhagim of the Seder. So therefore, even if I think that halakhically I'm not required to wash my hands a second time before matzah, we shouldn't really intentionally avoid that situation because at the end of the day, Chazal wanted us to wash our hands two times, and that's what should be done.
We didn't say a bracha on washing our hands the first time. So how are we going to now consider not washing and go right to motzi matzah?
So a bracha doesn't really mean that you didn't do a mitzvah per se, right? So if I wash my hands halakhically properly, so whether or not I say the bracha, so I wash my hands. That's true. You know, if I put on tefillin without saying the bracha, so I was supposed to say the bracha before I put on tefillin, but it doesn't really prevent me from doing the mitzvah. So that's the concern, is that really, you know, if you washed your hands properly the first time, even though you didn't say a bracha, maybe it's not relevant. So the Be'er Halacha explains that, you know, in theory, if somebody knew that they didn't touch anything that would make their hands impure, so they should wash their hands without making a bracha. But even in that scenario, one should, you know, purposely go to the bathroom or do something that would require them to wash their hands in order to, even technically touching your shoes, could render a requirement to do Netilas Yadayim. So do something that will warrant doing a Netilas Yadayim with a bracha before eating. So that's in terms of Rachza. Again, we do it two times, and part of that is obviously for halachic reasons, but even if the halachic reason were not to be relevant, that's part of the Seder that we wash two times. That's what we do. Okay. Now we get to the mitzvah of matzah, which I think will occupy a lot of our time tonight. So motzi matzah. So we start on page 320 with a debate in the Gemara about the role of matzah in our times. In our times, I mean the post Beis HaMikdash for the last 2,000 years. Is matzah an obligation from the Torah, or is it a rabbinic obligation? So read the Gemara inside, source 39, it says, Amar Rava, matzah b'zman hazeh d'oraisa umaror d'rabbanan. There's a mitzvah to eat matzah from the Torah nowadays, even without a Beis HaMikdash, but maror is only rabbinically mandated. The Gemara asks, logically, umayishna maror, what makes maror different? Dichtiv al-matzos umarami yochluhum. So the pasuk in Shmos chapter 12, when we are introduced to Korban Pesach, says that we're supposed to eat the Korban Pesach with matzah and maror. So it seems like matzah and maror are in the same category. So bisman de ika pesach ish maror, bisman de leika pesach leika maror. But we can learn from this that from the fact that the maror has to be eaten with the pesach. So if there's a Korban Pesach, we have maror. Without the Korban Pesach, we don't have maror. But matzah nami aksivam matzah sumarim. But shouldn't matzah have the same status? So matzah midar hadar be kraba erev tochlu matzos. There are actually two verses in chapter 12 of Shmos that tell us about the mitzvah to eat matzahs. One is related to the Korban Pesach, but one is completely independent. That says, but erev tochlu matzos, at the first night of Pesach, I have to have matzah. So based on that, since we don't have a Korban Pesach, so maror would be d'rabbanan because maror seems to be dependent on the Korban Pesach. But matzah seems to be independent of the Korban Pesach, so therefore it's d'oraisa. But then Rav Acha bar Yaakov comes and says, Echad zev, echad zev d'rabbanan. Both of them are really d'rabbanan. So that's the machlokas, that's the dispute that we have, whether matzah is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. One side says that matzah is d'oraisa because it's pasuk that says, Be'erv tochlu matzos. So even without the Korban Pesach, we have an obligation to eat matzah. And Rav Acha bar Yaakov says that they're both d'rabbanan without the Korban Pesach. So in source 40, the Rambam comes in paskins, mitzvahs aser min haTorah lechol matzah b'lo chamisha asar. It's a positive mitzvah from the Torah, ti matzah on the 15th of Nisan, shenemar be'erv tochlu matzos. At night we're supposed to eat matzah. And that applies at any time, any place, not independent. It's independent of the Beis HaMikdash or the Korban Pesach. But then it goes on to say that the rest of Pesach, eating matzah is technically optional. You're not really required to do it. And the reason for that, a little complicated, I'll try to explain it as succinctly as possible. So certainly the first night we have to eat matzah, that's in the Pasuk in Shmos Yibes. Other places where it's 7 days we're supposed to eat matzah, that would seem to imply that it's a mitzvah to eat matzah throughout all Pesach. But then there's another Pasuk that says that only 6 days we eat matzah. So what do we make of that? Sounds like that the last day of Pesach, the seventh day of Pesach, which really commemorates Kriyas Yamsuf, the crossing of the sea. So matzah is not really required that day. So from the fact that matzah is not required on the seventh day, I learned that on the other days it's not required, except the first night, you know, has its own bona fide independent obligation. So on Pesach night, I absolutely must make a bracha hamotzi and have matzah. The rest of Pesach, if I want to wash and have matzah, so I'm, you know, fulfilling the mitzvah and doing so, but it's not a real obligation. So Rambam makes reference to that here. He mentions here, ratza ochal matzah, ratza ochal orez. If you want to eat matzah, you can eat matzah. If you want to eat rice, you can eat rice. Rambam holds that you can eat rice on Pesach. That is only true if you are a Sephardi. I won't get into the whole issue right now. Okay, so the question that we get into, we have an obligation to eat matzah. So how much matzah do we have to have? So Rashi makes a comment where he talks about how the way we do matzah is that we have three matzahs. So the top matzah we make hamotzi on, and then the middle matzah we break in half, and part is saved for the afikomen, and the other part is for the mitzvah of achilas matzah. But because of the requirement of lecha mishnah, because on Shabbos and Yom Tov I have to have two complete pieces of bread, or you know, not just a piece, but you know, complete loaf, so to speak. In our case, a complete matzah. So I have to have three matzahs at the seder, so that when I make hamotzi, that in addition to the broken part, which is part of the mitzvah of eating matzah, that I have two whole ones. So that means I have to have three matzahs. That's what we get from Rashi. Rashi explains that the broken matzah does not count towards Lecha Mishnah. Rambam holds differently. He says you make netilah etc. He says Rambam only mentions two matzahs, and he explicitly mentions that when we make hamotzi, that we break the second matzah in half. So according to the Rambam, when you make hamotzi on the Seder night, you have 1.5 matzahs, which must mean that for the purposes of Lecha Mishnah, that the broken matzah counts as sufficiently for that reason. So Rashi explains that based on Rashi, we have three matzahs, and again, we know the whole story that that we split the second one in half. One's part's for the afikomen, part is for achilas matzah. And he says that we eat a kezayis from both the top matzah and the middle matzah. Third matzah is saved for Korach. Once we once we have that, we save it for Korach to do a mitzvah with it. But with the top and the middle matzah, we have to eat a kezayis from both of them. We have to eat the worth of an olive from both of them. So it seems a little bit strange that we have to have. So, by the way, in terms of the Rambam's position that we only have two matzahs, so I don't think most people pass in that way. But the Vilna Gaon held like the Rambam to only have two matzahs, and that became the tradition in Volozhin, Rav Chaim Volozhin, and his descendants, the Soloveitchik family, also only has two matzahs on Pesach, as far as I'm aware. That's a very unique approach. Most people have three. But so the Rashbam made reference to having a kezayis of matzah from both the top and the middle matzah. That's a question that the Bach asks in source 44. So the Shulchan Aruch says in source 45 that in fact that we eat the matzah while reclining and we eat a kezayis from both matzahs. If you can't eat the two together, first you eat the kezayis from the top matzah, and then the kezayis from the middle matzah. So,
practically speaking, what do you do with the? I mean, that if you have three matzahs on the table and you're eating a kezayis, that satisfies one person, practically.
I'll get to that. I'll get to that momentarily. I'll get to that momentarily. So there's machlokas about whether the top matzah requires a kezayis or the middle matzah, right? Which one is really the essential part of the mitzvah of eating matzah? So Mishnah Berurah explains that from the broken matzah, you should definitely need to have a kezayis because you make the bracha of al achilas matzah. So in achila, to eat something requires a kezayis. That's generally true in halacha. For something to count halachically as eating, it has to be something of has to mean be a meaningful substance. Right? Just taking putting a crumb in your mouth is not eating. So for the purpose of al achilas matzah, we make the bracha on the mitzvah of eating matzah. So you definitely have to have a kezayis. Right. We have these two brachas. We have hamotzeh min ha'aretz and al achilas matzah. So it would seem that one applies to one matzah and the other applies to the other matzah. So generally speaking, I think we understand that the top matzah, the big the whole matzah, we make hamotzi, and the broken matzah is for the mitzvah of al achilas matzah. But there's some who say it's the opposite, that the top that the whole matzah is al achilas matzah, and the broken one is that we make hamotzi. So since we don't know which one is the one for al achilas matzah, we have a kezayis from both of them. So there come that would explain the Russian's requirement to have two alas worth of matzah at the Seder. The Mishnah Berurah goes on to say, though, that if somebody only had one kezayis, then they have fulfilled their obligation. That's sufficient. So then they note in the footnote here, which would explain Tony's question, that if you only have three matzahs for the whole table, right? The Baal HaSeder has three matzahs. It's just like a Shabbos table. You have two challahs that that the host makes hamotzi on the challahs and breaks it up and passes it around. As we'll see, the volume of kezayis for matzah is a little bit big. So how do you give a kazayas of matzah to everybody around the table from these three matzahs? So the position of Rabbi Kiva Iger and Rav Eliashiv is that really only the head of the household has to have two kazaysim, and everybody else can have one kazayas. So that's one way that helps. I think what I started doing when I went to my in-laws, that's a practice that their family has. Also, that at least for I don't know if the women do this, but I think all the men have their own tray of matzos. So that also helps. If everybody has their own matzah, if everyone has their own matzah, then you can really use all the matzahs, which is very practical. Because again, if you're using one for if you're having two kazaysim and then you're using a third one for korech, so it kind of makes sense to have. But that's not always practical. Could even be a little expensive. So it's enough for everybody to have one kazais. And then the other thing that could be done is that everybody gets a little bit of the matzah from Hamotzi, and then everybody takes a little bit more matzah in order to have their full kazais.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I always, for many, many years, we've been doing, I think I may have learned it from Rabbi Riskin when I was a teenager, that whoever's making hamotzi has to, when he makes the first bracha of hamotzi lechem menorahs, has to pick up all 2.5 matzahs and make hamotzi because he has to have lechem mishnah in his hands because like a Shabbos or Yontif. And
Right.
then he's supposed to put down the bottom matzah and make the bracha of alachilos matzah on a broken portion to represent the lechemoni.
Right. Right.
And
Yeah. Yeah, that's
is
correct.
that the way it's done? Because you
Yeah,
didn't
that's
mention
correct.
anything about holding them in your hand and putting it down. That's the way it's supposed to be done.
Yeah, I
That's what
don't,
we've been
yeah.
doing. I was looking at it. I didn't see anything about that, but
Yeah,
that's how we
no,
always
no, no,
do it.
that, no, yeah, that is, yeah.
And I was also,
Yeah.
as I also remember that you're not allowed to talk from the time you wash for hamotzi until after Korech, which is really difficult because it means giving out the Mara portions and the Korech portions without talking at all. Do you know, is that because that's how I remember learning it, I believe, with Rabbi Rifkin.
Theoretically, that is accurate because Korech in some ways is part of the fulfillment of being matzah. According to Hillel's approach, that you have to have the maror and the matzah together. So that's why you shouldn't really talk through Korech. With that said, I think if you have to talk for a purpose of a mitzvah, so even with regular Shabbos, if you need the salt, so you don't have to like make strange noises, you can say, "Can I please have the salt?" So I think also if you're passing around the maror and become requires a little bit of communication, I think that's fine. But ideally, both of those points are correct, including that one should avoid talking from washing until
Okay.
eating korach.
I drive everybody in my family crazy about that not talking.
Good for you. That's good. That's good. Okay. So question comes up: how big is a kazai? So this is a big discussion. So Shulchan Aruch says that kazayis is half an egg, and the Kaf HaChaim says that we do it by weight, but Rav Melamed points out in source 50 that we generally do things by volume and not by weight. So when we talk about so when we talk about matzah, that's flat, right? So when you have like a we have a challah, so like an olive. Something that's the size of an olive is the size of an olive because it's dense. When it comes to matzah, though, so if we're talking about volume, so it's not, you don't just take a little piece and say, oh, this looks like, it sort of like fits what an olive would be. It has to have the volume. So that's how Pnei Halacha explains it. So in terms of there are a couple different approaches to how big practically speaking, kazayis has to be, and the Nora Behuda and the Chazon Ish claimed that the size of eggs were really bigger than they are now. So really, we have to have a very large portion of matzah. Practically speaking, it's really not, for the purpose of alachilos matzah, or for the purpose of fulfilling your obligation of matzah. It's enough to have 2/3 of a shvuah matzah or 3/4. Think about this, right? We're 3/4 of the machine matzah. And you really fulfill both. That way, you either get two kazaysim based on the smallest measurement, Or you get one big kazayas according to the bigger measurement. We're not going to be machmir, on chumrah. So having 2/3 of a machine matzah would be considered sufficient for the mitzvah of matzah. Only one only has a third, then that would again be yeah, but that should really be okay. Okay, on page 324, the question of matzah shmura. So we find something in the store called shmur matzah. So what is shmur matzah about? So it can really mean a couple of different things, right? So shmura means to be guarded, and there is a pasuk in the Torah that says ushmartem asam matzos, that you should guard, watch carefully the matzos. You know, based on that, the Rambam says that the purpose of shmur matzah is to make sure that the matzah doesn't become chametz stick. Rashi says in source 53, in a comment on the Gemara Pesachim, that shalot tachbitz, he's kaven l'shem kol shimur shatam mishamra shalot tachbitz, he's kaven l'shem matzah shel mitzvah. The purpose of shmur matzah is that we should intend that the matzah that we're having is done for the purpose of a mitzvah, right? Tzitzis have to be done for the purpose of tzitzis, and tefillin have to be done for the purpose of tefillin, and somebody who is making those items has to verbalize that. So likewise, at least in terms of one's intention, in terms of what's in mind, so one would have to have in mind that the matzah is being done for the purpose of a mitzvah, right? It's not just something we're putting on the store shelves, but it's being done for the purpose of the night. So Mr. Burr talks about the requirement to have shmur matzahs. So especially the first, the Seder nights of the first two nights of Pesach, one should be careful to have a shmur matzah, both because of the element of making sure that, because they're guarded more carefully in terms of not becoming chametz, but also because they're done for the purpose of a mitzvah. And the first two nights is when we really have the obligation of eating matzah. But the other nights, you don't technically have to have shmur matzah. But obviously, to some extent, all matzah that's marked kosher Pesach probably meets the minimal requirements of shmura. But in terms of the purpose of being done for the mitzvah, one should have shmur matzah for the seder. One question that this forces is whether or not I'm allowed to have machine matzah and my seder. Right. So one important implication. So there are really two concerns that could come from that. One is that are the machines sufficiently equipped to make sure that the matzah does not come to be chametz stick in any fashion? Second thing is, can the machine have in mind to not, can the machine have in mind to be l'shem mitzvah matzahs, right? Does that work? If I press a button, so do all the matzahs that come out of it count as being for the purpose of a mitzvah? So I guess this was written in the late 19th century. The Avnei Nezer was very against machine matzahs, and he bases this on the Ger Rebbe and the Tzanzer Rebbe and the Chachanov Rebbe, said that he definitely cannot use them. Even compares them this week's parsha to Tzaras and to Tuma. He says that essentially, it can become chametz. So it could be. It could be that once upon a time that the machines were not necessarily so sophisticated. So it might have been that the machines maybe, there could be concern that there would be things that would get stuck that would become chametz. Nowadays, I don't think we have that concern. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that if machine matzah is being done for the purpose of the mitzvah, so you can fulfill your obligation with that on the Seder night, and you can make the bracha al achilas matzah. So he said that it might be better to have the hand matzah as it's being done, with tremendous care. The people who are doing the shmur matzah by hand are doing it with tremendous care. Chacham Avadia advocated doing a handmade matzah, especially because that agrees with most opinions. But he says that you can use shmur matzah. So there is such a thing as machine shmur matzah, and that one could use that for the night of the Seder. Some might say that one should use it, that one should use the hand matzah. Okay, and it's enough about matzah. Okay, let's go to Mara. Maybe we'll do Korech, and maybe we'll stop after Correct. We'll see what time it is.
It takes 25 minutes, 26.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm doing about 10 minutes really. Okay, so on page 343, we got the requirement for Maror. As we mentioned before, the Pasuk in Shmos says, that you should eat the Korban Pesach with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. So, as we mentioned before, the Gemara seems to, to debate whether or not the matzah is a mitzvah from the Torah nowadays, but Maror, everybody seems to agree, is rabbinic nowadays because of the association of Korban Pesach. Since there's no Korban Pesach, there's no real obligation to have Maror, but it's something we do on a rabbinic level. That's what the Rambam brings in source 3 on page 344. Fine. So what counts as Maror? So Gemara says, I'm Lamatat Amaral, source 4, according to Rabbi Yoshaya, mitzvah b'chazeres, you should use chazeres. So Rava says, my chazeres. Okay, so if you don't know this Gemara and you're wondering what chazeres is, so you're not alone there. So what's chazeres? Chasa, which is lettuce. So why chasa? The chasa rachmana, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu had mercy on us. Which, again, we're using this for Maror, so it almost seems like kind of ironic that the bitter herbs are associated with God having mercy on us. Okay, but that's what the Gemara says, that chazeres is chasa, and chasa is about HaKadosh Baruch Hu having mercy over us. And Shulchan Aruch, Paskins, it goes through different vegetables which could count as Maror, but he says ikar mitzvah b'chazeres, but the primary mitzvah is to do it with lettuce. So the Chazon Ish felt that lettuce nowadays should not really be used because the lettuce that we have nowadays is relatively sweet, maybe not bitter. So if you are going to use lettuce, then it should be. There is a point where lettuce apparently in the growing process becomes a little bit more bitter. So one would have to wait to. One would have to wait to pick the lettuce to meet that criteria according to the Chazon Ish. But the Yerushalmi gives a different explanation for what Maror is really about. And so in this source 7, it says, Matok, just as Maror is sweet at the beginning and bitter at the end, that's what the Egyptians did to us. So Paro, Yosef's Paro, told Bnei Yisrael to settle, in the best of the land. And obviously, Yosef and his family were treated with great respect when they got to Egypt. So the beginning of being in Egypt worked out pretty well. But afterwards, they embittered our lives with hard work. So just like lettuce starts sweet, but then it has like sort of a bitter aftertaste, or as it grows, it becomes more bitter also. So too, that's the idea behind Maror. It's probably something homiletic here about the experience in most places in the diaspora that it often starts off very well and then ends up not quite as well. Something I think a lot of us have been thinking about this year. So Shulchan Aruch HaRav of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe doubles down on this and explains that even though Maror, that the lettuce Maror is not so bitter, so when it's in the ground, so the stem hardens and becomes bitter. And even though we eat it at the sweet stage, the vegetable itself is Maror. So one proof that the Chazon Ish uses in his favor is that we. When we do charoset, we're supposed to shake off the charoset from the maror so that the charoset doesn't sweeten the maror too much. So that'll make it seem like that the taste of the maror actually has to be a bit bitter. But Rashi Weiss says otherwise on page 346, verse 9. In truth, it is a great novelty to say that not being able to taste the flavor can prevent one from filling the mitzvah. For eating is written in the Torah, so from where would we know to add this novelty that taste is intrinsic part of the mitzvah? In truth, it seems that there's no need to taste the flavor of the maror. Rather, one has to eat it in a manner that one would be able to taste the bitter flavor. For there's no specific definition for what is called bitter, since that which is bitter for one person is not bitter for another person, as is known. So what Rav Asher Weiss is saying is that to say that you have to eat something that's bitter, so that's too subjective and qualitative. to really fulfill an objective mitzvah. So that's obviously not what we're going for. What we shouldn't do is add something that will dafka sweeten the maror, but to the extent of how bitter is the maror really, so that's going to depend from person to person. But the mitzvah is not really about what the taste is like. The mitzvah is I'm obligated to eat the maror. So therefore the eating has to be, the putting the maror in my mouth is what's significant. So with that said, on page 347, Sefer Yerim explains that, that's one of the Balei Tosfos, explains that the maror has to be kezayis, it has to be an olive worth. I think generally like sort of like one, you know, one stalk of lettuce fulfills our obligation for that purpose. So that's the amount that should be eaten. Obviously one for maror itself and then one for korech. Gemara Pesachim mentions that matzo we eat while reclining. Maror we don't eat while reclining. Rashi and Rashbam explain because we're not going to recline when we're being reminded about a bitter experience. And when we're commemorating the slavery, so we're not going to redeem, right? Because we're supposed to portray ourselves as if we left Egypt. So, you know, just like we lean to portray ourselves as being free, we also portray ourselves in the situation of bondage in that sense. We make the bracha al achilas maror, we eat without hasiba. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. And the first Shulchan Aruch talks about shaking out the charoset, as we mentioned. So Mishnah Berurah in source 15 mentions that the idea of putting charoset on in the first place is because there was concerns that the lettuce had poisons in it, and putting the charoset on was able to get rid of the poison. Mm-hmm. I do not understand this, but that's what the assumption was. Nonetheless, we put in the charoset, we shake it off, and as we mentioned before, we don't make a bor pri adama. That could be a discussion of why we don't make a bor pri adama. But as Rashi says in source 17, we assume that the bor pri adama we said for karpas exempts us when we get to mar. So let's finish off with talking about korech. So Gemara in Pesachim, this is source 18, page 349, says that Hillel would put the whole Korban Pesach together and eat it as a sandwich. So literally, Korban Pesach is eating with matzah and maror. Sounds like, as I think Rabbi Weider explained once, that Korech is a shawarma, essentially. That you have the matzah, and by the way, there is such a thing as soft matzahs, which they, I don't know if they had that in time based on Mikdash, so whatever, it's a hardy thing to do now, but in theory, you could, you know, wrap your matzah around the Korban Pesach and maror. That's essentially a shawarma, you know, or something like that. So there were those who disagreed and said that, and that was most of Phil's colleagues, by the way, that you might think that you have to eat them together, but when it says al matzot umarim yochlu hu in the singular, so you can eat matzah by itself and you can eat the maror by themselves. So then Gemara goes on to say that the halacha was not explicitly paskined one way or another. So as a compromise, we eat the matzah by itself and then the maror by itself in deference to the chachamim. But then we do korech in order to defer to Hillel, and we call it Zecher LeMikdash KeHillel, that commemorates the way Hillel ate the Korban Pesach in the Beis HaMikdash. So Shulchan Aruch explains source 20. V'achar kach notel matzah shlishi sevotzei mimena v'korcha im hamar. So you take a third matzah and you like split it in half so that you can make it into a sandwich with the maror, and you dip it into charoset. This commemorates Beis HaMikdash. So even though there's maror on this, we do eat it while reclining. This is what Susan mentioned before, that once you made the bracha on matzah, and really from Netilas Yadayim, one shouldn't discuss anything that's not related to the needs of the meal until you have this korech. Because we want the mitzvah of eating matzah to and the bracha for matzah, the bracha for maror to apply to korech as After this comes the Shulchan Aruch, and the one thing I'll just mention, it's not so much what we discuss, the role of the, we don't eat roasted things, and we don't eat things that are roasted in the oven, even if it's done without, we don't eat roasted things. And then there's the concept of eating an egg, which is either a reference to the fact that the day of Tisha B'Av always falls out on the day that Pesach takes place. It's one explanation of it, or it's that it commemorates the Korban Chagiga. But Rama, and then I'll really end up with this, Rama says in verse 27 that one shouldn't eat or drink too much during the meal. We don't want, on the one hand, don't drink too much because we don't want you to get too drunk before you have afikomen and finish the mitzvahs of the night. And in terms of eating, so if you eat something while you're stuffed to capacity and then you shove it down for the sake of shoving it down, so that's not achila, that's achila gasa, that's gluttonous eating, and that halachically does not count as eating. So we have to make sure when we have afikomen that we have, you know, a reasonable degree of appetite left. Now, it's popular, especially, in America to, Seder night is a big night. So, like, it's usually, one of the biggest meals of the year. Truth be told, it really doesn't have to be that way. And actually, we were discussing this this year. We might really just do chicken soup with the chicken in it and kreplach and maybe one or two other things, and then afikomen. By the time you have the matzah at the beginning, and then and korech and soup, there's not so much more they really have to have before you get to afikomen. You know, maybe a little bit of dessert. So that's something to think about.